formula and diapers spread across, you know, the blood of these drivers who were killed exactly 1 week ago today, a massive bombing campaign across civilian areas, killing over 300 people, you know, in what Lebanese are calling Black Wednesday. So for many, you know, also, of course, the exclusion of Hezbollah from these talks, it makes many believe them to be unserious. The talks are about Hezbollah's weapons, but Hezbollah isn't there. And the Lebanese government, as Daniel said before me, is unable to disarm this group. So what exactly are these negotiations really doing other than, you know, giving Netanyahu basically the green light to kind of, or at least the ability to buy more time for his aggression in Lebanon, something clearly stated already by the Israeli press. And I think, you know, it's also important to remember, many Lebanese don't see the Israelis or their American guarantors as reliable negotiating partners. You know, the Oslo peace process was supposed to be a peace process. Instead, you know, in the subsequent decades, we see the entrenchment of the occupation, settlement building in the West Bank, the transformation of the Palestinian Authority into this, you know, effectively a police force for the Israelis. And of course, in the 15 months before the current escalation, right, the UN counted over 15,000 violations by Israel of the agreement with Lebanon. You know, I first time I came on your show, Amy, I told you about a man named Mustafa Arut from the border village of Meis Jabal. And he had lost two young relatives, Haider and Ruqayya, ages 2 and 4, under Israeli bombs in the early days of this escalation. And I've been following up with him throughout this war, and I reached out to him this morning because I wanted his thoughts on the negotiation. I want to read you what he said. I translated it. He said, "How are you going to negotiate with an enemy that is killing you under the bombs? We can only negotiate from a logical place, not while we are under fire. We have to first protect our people, protect our country. We left our home with nothing but the clothes on our backs. We have fled 5 times over the course of our lives. Since the year 1948, we have paid with our blood. We don't want parties. We don't want masters. We want a nation. We want the state to protect us as a nation. For us people of the South, the land is not just trees and stones and dirt. It's our history, our parents and grandparents, our heritage, our livelihoods, our pride, our dignity. This is what breaks our hearts. I saw yesterday images of our village, how they're going through it with bulldozers, tearing everything up, making it unfit for life. But we will return, if even to dust, and we will pitch tents on top of it, and God will take care of the rest."
Leila Younis, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Investigative journalist, writer, based in Beirut. We'll link to your piece in Drop Site News. It's titled, "Massive Israeli Assault on Lebanon Threatens U.S.-Iran Ceasefire." Coming up, Democratic Congress member Eric Swalwell and Republican Congress member Tony Gonzalez have resigned from Congress ahead of potential expulsion votes after being accused of sexual misconduct involving former staffers and more. Stay with us.
I landed here from Punjab. Kuli pukarda jag sanu. No real home but in Kilab. In Kilab. Oh, in Kilab. No real home but in Kilab.
Sunny Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our viewers and listeners, this story contains references to rape and sexual abuse. We turn now to Capitol Hill, where Democratic Congressmember Oxwalla of California, Republican Tony Gonzalez of Texas, both resigned Congress on Tuesday. Each had faced potential expulsion votes after being accused of sexual misconduct involving former staffers. On Tuesday, New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said this moment should mark a, quote, important resetting point in Congress, saying abuse of power should never be accepted and above all in public office, unquote. Congressmember Swalwell's resignation came just days after CNN and the San Francisco Chronicle reported multiple allegations of sexual misconduct against him. In one case, a former staffer said Swalwell raped her twice, leaving her bruised and bleeding. She told CNN the misconduct began when she was a 21-year-old staffer.
It was in 2019. I was, again, driving him to an event. This was my job.
And you were 21 years old?
And I was 21 years old. We see some sort of parking lot, and he says to pull over. He pulls out his penis and instructs me to give him oral sex. And I started to. Again, I felt incredibly uncomfortable, and I stopped, and I said to him, this feels really uncomfortable, and anyone could see us right now. And he said to me, you're right. It's probably not good for a congressman to be caught with his pants down.
The staffer went on to describe another time waking up naked in his hotel room and a third incident in 2024 when he raped her years after she'd stopped working for him. Eric Swalwell has denied the allegations. On Sunday, he dropped out of the California gubernatorial race. Swalwell's resignation from Congress came on the same day a California woman named Lana Drews came forward and said Swalwell raped her in 2018 after he promised to help her make business connections.
He invited me to two public events. I knew he was married at the time and that his wife was pregnant. He was my friend. On the third occasion, I believe he drugged my drink. I only had one glass of wine. We were supposed to go to a political event, and he said he needed to get paperwork from his hotel room. When I arrived at his hotel room, I was already incapacitated, and I couldn't move my arms or my body. He raped me, and he choked me. And while he was choking me, I lost consciousness. And I thought I died.
Republican Congressmember Tony Gonzalez's resignation from Congress yesterday comes 2 months after the San Antonio Express News revealed he had an affair with a staffer who later took her own life. The paper also revealed Gonzalez had previously sent explicit text messages to another staffer. We're joined now by Fatima Goss Graves, president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Your response to what has taken place?
Well, as of today, these two members are no longer a part of Congress, but that certainly shouldn't be the end of the story of accountability here. It shouldn't be the end of the examination that Congress should be undertaking into why it is they keep having these very serious types of allegations of abuses of power. And it also should focus and refocus the mind on the fact that Congress is there not just to handle itself, but they should be looking at the way in which sexual harassment and violence is pervasive in many institutions across this country. A reset, as Representative Ocasio-Cortez said, is exactly right.
Talk about what needs to happen right now And whether or not, well, it's very clear that Eric Swalwell, the Congress member who was one of the top candidates for the Democratic governor's primary in California, will be criminally charged from New York, the Manhattan DA investigating him, to California. And if Congress should still bring charges or sanction or censure these men, even after they've left.
So, for sure, as individuals, I think we're going to see a lot more investigating. And the survivors who have come forward to share their experience, they deserve far more than that. So you may see both criminal and civil investigations happening, and each of them will be responding to that. But Congress itself shouldn't see these resignations as the end of the story here. They actually should see it as the beginning of investigating not only what happened with these two individuals, but they need to understand whether or not they have a problem that is more of a pattern. If you were talking about any other employment setting and you saw two very powerful individuals with very serious allegations, you would wonder if you had a pattern. And so Congress, I think, has a problem of it only investigating itself. They probably need some sort of outside, independent, and transparent look at into what exactly is happening, whether staffers and interns and other people who engage regularly with Congress are experiencing harassment and violence, and whether or not their systems of reporting are working at all.
And then there are another two Congress members, both from Florida, calls in Congress for Republican Corey Mills and Democrat Sheila Chafalas McCormick. Mills is facing a House ethics investigation into domestic violence and campaign finance violations.
So here's the thing. When I think about both Gonzalez and some of these other allegations, they've been out there for a long time. And it should not be that you have to wait for some sort of bipartisan infraction for Congress to do something about it, to either threaten expulsion, to take a very serious vote. When you have the level of information that the Ethics Committee has had, it seems like they should have been moving forward anyway. You know, when you talk about why this is happening, part of what is going on is you have a sense of entitlement and a sense that there won't be consequences no matter the conduct. And that comes from the highest levels. The tone that is being set right now about having no consequence, whether you're talking about the president for his own actions or other cabinet members, there needs to be a giant reset.
And finally, the Epstein files, Fatima Goss-Graves. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi failed to appear on Tuesday to testify under oath before the House Oversight Committee regarding her handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files, 3 million pages still not released.
You know, what a clear violation of law that was very explicit around what the Department of Justice should be doing right now. And I think that is not the end of the story for Pam Bondi. It isn't enough for her to resign and just wander away as if she has nothing to do. Congress was very clear. They were demanding that she testify and they should hold her into contempt for not returning and doing what she should do. This is an example where the survivors, against all odds, have continued to come forward and demand serious accountability. They're doing it even though the president has said he doesn't want it. They're doing it even though the Department of Justice has obstructed them along the way. I suspect we will see real accountability here. No one is above the law.
And this latest news from CNN, over Trump has been mentioned over 1,000 times in the Epstein files. Fatima Goss-Graves, I want to thank you so much for being with us, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. Of course, we will continue to follow these issues. Coming up, The Future is Peace, a shared journey across the Holy Land, a new book jointly written by a Palestinian peace activist and an Israeli peace activist. Maoz Zinan's parents were killed by Hamas October 7th. Aziz Abu Sara's brother died after being tortured in Israeli prison. Stay with us. Palestinian Youth Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Future is Peace, a shared journey across the Holy Land. That's the name of a new book by our next guests, Aziz Abu Sara and Maoz Zinan. One is a Palestinian peace activist, the other an Israeli peace activist. They first met after Maoz Zinan's parents were killed in the October 7, 2023 attacks by Hamas. Over the past 2 years, they've closely worked together, calling for peace in Israel and Palestine. In a moment, they join us. But first, I want to turn to an excerpt from the documentary The Path Forward, directed by Julie Cohen and Mo Husseini. The clip begins with Aziz talking about reaching out to Maoz after October 7th.
It didn't matter to me that Maoz's parents were Jewish. That's not part of the calculation. When people talk about October 7th, it's Israelis versus Palestinians. It didn't feel to me Israelis versus Palestinians. Those who were hurt, those who were killed were my people too.
I just replied immediately, thank you for being there.
A few days later, he made a post on Twitter.
I am not crying for my parents. I am crying for those who will lose their lives in this war.
He doesn't want revenge, and he doesn't want what's happened to him to cause more people to suffer. And I said, it took me 8 years to come to that point. When my brother, Taysir, died, he was 19 years old, and I was 10 years old. He was arrested on suspicion of throwing rocks. He was beaten up in prison by an Israeli soldier, which caused internal injuries. He died as a result of those injuries. It's still painful. A few days after Maoz's parents were killed, it's just, I can't imagine stepping out of your pain to think of somebody else's pain, to think of what other people are going through. It takes so much of a humanity of someone to do that. So I wrote him that, and he sent me a message right away saying, let's talk.
I knew that my life has changed dramatically. It's not just what happened to my parents, my childhood friends, Israelis. I knew that a war is just about to happen, and a war that we have never experienced before in our lifetime. So every contact, every bridge, every relationship that I knew that I would be able to build with Palestinians, it's very meaningful. Not just for me, Maoz, as a person, but for the region.
An excerpt from the short documentary, The Path Forward, directed by Julie Cohen and Mo Husseini. In 2024, Aziz Abu Sara and Maoz Zinan met with Pope Francis. And just about a year ago, they then met with Pope Leo shortly after he became Pope. We're joined in studio by Aziz and Maoz, co-authors of this new book, The future is peace, a shared journey across the Holy Land. Aziz, what makes you so hopeful to say the future is peace?
I'm hopeful because I've worked in many other conflicts around the world. I was in Colombia, I was in Northern Ireland, I was in South Africa, I was in all these places. And what I've learned is that it doesn't matter how horrible a moment is, and the moment we are in today is very terrible. I have friends in Gaza who lost their entire families. I have friends like Maoz who lost his parents. My brother was killed. That every conflict ends at the end.
How did your brother die?
My brother died due to...
And how old was he?
He died due to torture in Israeli prison when he was arrested on allegation of throwing rocks. He was taken from home, and he refused to confess, so he was tortured, and he died soon after he was released from prison. He was 19 when he died, and I was 10. And so I grew up angry. I grew up believing peace is impossible. But at some point I realized, when I was 18, that Maoz and I are not on the opposite sides. To bring justice, to bring peace, to bring equality and dignity to all of us, we have to work together. It can't be Israelis versus Palestinians. It has to be those of us who believe in justice and equality and peace working together versus those who don't believe it yet. And the goal is to bring everyone to believe in it as well. And we will get there, because if they did it in Northern Ireland, and if they did it in South Africa, and they dismantled oppression and systems of oppression in those places, then there's no reason we cannot do it.
How do you see it ending here? How do you see the occupation ending?
The solution, I think, is less the problem, in the sense it can work in a one-state solution, can work in two-state solution, can work in confederation, which would be my preferred solution. But I think the more important is what are the values and what this solution is built on. Any solution that is not based on equality, any solution does not see dignity, recognition, and safety for everyone, it will fail. It can be two states, like Russia and Ukraine are two states. It's not working. It can be Rwanda, one state. We saw what happened there. It's all about what values you build on. And if we don't promote those values and saying Maoz's life and my life and my family's life and his family's life are equal, then every solution would fail. That's what we should be focusing on.
Maoz, can you talk about your feelings when Aziz reached out to you, and then this friendship that you have developed over these years with both of your parents now dead?
Yeah. So it was only 3 days after I lost my parents and many of my childhood friends and people I knew my entire life. And I was literally, not as a metaphor, I was literally drowning in an ocean of sorrow and pain. And when Aziz reached out to me 3 days after, offering his condolences, it was like a hand saving me from drowning in this ocean. And in the last 2.5 years, we've been working together, quartering The Future is Peace. And now I can say, yes, October 7th was the most tragic day of my life. I lost so much and so many. But on that day, I also won Aziz. And I want Aziz as a brother, and a brother to our shared journey. And I'm hopeful because I know that all conflicts end in the end. It doesn't matter if they last days, weeks, months, years, or decades, or centuries. History proves they end in the end. And the only question we should ask ourselves is when and how many lives will be lost. And what is already proven through history, that we need enough people that realize that we have the agency to change the future, to create the future we deserve to live within. And this is exactly many of the stories we bring to life in our shared journey, is stories from the biblical time, mythology, history, and we share many stories of the people we meet. We are meeting Batya Segev, a friend of my parents from the kibbutz, who lost her daughter, her son-in-law, and two of her grandchild. And an hour after, we are speaking to Abdel Rahim in Gaza, who lost so many of his family members. And they are both sharing their pain, their suffering, but they also encourage us, supporting us on our shared journey.
As you speak to the Jewish community here in the United States, I'm wondering your thoughts and your sense of how many, for example, feel the way Senator Bernie Sanders does, who has promised to advance a resolution to block bombs and bulldozers to Israel in Congress.
I think what matters is not where they are today, is where they can be in the future. And one of the most remembered day in the life of the state of Israel was the day Anwar Sadat, the president of Israel, visited Israel in 1977, only 4 years after he waged war over Israel. And while the 2 weeks before, the entire discourse in Israel in the Jewish diaspora were against negotiation, not against peace agreement, not against land swap. They were against negotiation. And day after he visited Israel, the discourse changed completely. So we need to remember ourselves that, and the others, that discourse, public opinion, they are very flexible. And we, the leaders, if it's within the civil society, if it's like Bernie Sanders, we are the one that should bring the change within the discourse.
Aziz, I'm wondering if you can talk about your visits with the popes, Pope Francis and then Pope Leo. Certainly Pope Leo in the headlines right now, because Trump has been attacking the first U.S.-born pope. And Leo's response has been, even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood, in a reference to what the U.S. has been saying overall, especially with the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, talking about President Trump responding that Leo is weak on foreign policy and going further, even releasing this AI image of himself, President Trump, as Jesus Christ.
Yes, and I've read the Bible, so did my Oz, and we talk a lot about faith in our work, and in Arabic the name of God is Salam, which means peace, and in Hebrew it's Shalom, which means peace as well. And if God is peace, then his followers should be going in that direction. Blessed are the peacemakers is what the Bible says. Love your enemies, pray those for those who persecute you. When we met Pope Francis, we met him in front of 12,000-13,000 people in the Arena Tipace, a Roman theater. And as we told our story, everyone stood up and started cheering for us. And he invited us to him and then gave us a big hug and said, you are brothers, which means Maoz and I are tied together forever because in Catholicism there's no divorce. But he also told us the only place there's no disagreement in the world is a cemetery. You'll always have disagreement. It's about how we solve these disagreements. We, as humans, can solve it through diplomacy, through talking to each other. And it was the same when we met Pope Leo. It was very clear to us. He was just had become the Pope, that peace is something he prioritized. We were among the first people to meet him. He invited a delegation of peacemakers to meet with him, and he highlighted our peace work and said, this is the work that is needed today. So I'm not surprised to see him speaking about peacemaking.
I should say that Leo said, Pope Leo said, made his comments about your hands are full of blood after Hegseth's prayers for violence. And I wanted to end with Maoz. What responsibility does the U.S. have as an obstacle to peace? Israel backed by this enormous military might of the United States. We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah, so the U.S. has huge responsibility in letting the war going on and supporting it with weapon and Iron Dome diplomatic approval for everything Israel is doing. But this is exactly why we are here today in your studio, Amy, to call the American people. If the common people like ourselves and member of the Congress and politician and leader, it's also within your agency to join us and to bring peace to the Holy Land.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Maoz Inon, Aziz Abusara, co-authors of the new book, The Future is Peace, A Shared Journey Across the Holy Land. That does it for our show. I'll be in Los Angeles tonight through Friday night for the theatrical release of Steal the Story, Please, the documentary about Democracy Now!, tonight at the North Hollywood Lemley, tomorrow night in Glendale. I'll also be in San Francisco and in Berkeley and in San Rafael and in Sonoma. Check out the website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
You know why you listen to this station. It plays new music, supports your community, and provides up-to-date news that you know you can trust. And unlike other stations, the people who work and volunteer here are a part of your community. Remember, though, they do this on a shoestring budget. The solution is the Community Radio Initiative. You can find out more details at mycri.ca. In just a few clicks, you can generate an email to send to the politicians who need to hear your message. mycri.ca.